Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is May the 13th, 2020. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. What states have the fastest and slowest internet in the United States in 2020? Are you looking for what high-speed internet service is available in your area? HighSpeedInternet.com makes exploring internet availability simple. With thousands of internet providers in their database, they'll find the information for you. You just enter your zip code to view all the internet options in your area. You can view providers side by side to compare features and to select the speed you need. Choose the option that'll make the most difference for your connected household. You'll be able to read before you buy with ratings and feedback from real customers. Check out their candid provider reviews to make an informed choice. See which internet providers are available in your state. With many shifting to working from home and homeschooling recently, Americans have had to reevaluate their internet needs. At HighSpeedInternet.com, they just passed 3 million speed tests completed on their site. They wanted to know which states have the fastest and slowest internet in the United States. The methodology was that the data analyst looked at data from 3 million speed test tool results and took the average internet speed of every state in the United States, then ranked them from fastest to slowest. You can see the full report at HighSpeedInternet.com. But here's a couple snapshots of some of the results. The states with the fastest internet based on speed test: Maryland, 84.1 megabits per second. Delaware, 80.9. Followed by New Jersey, 76.3. The District of Columbia, that's Washington, D.C., 75.2. And the fifth, Virginia, 74.5. Well, what about the slowest? Well, and the states with the slowest internet based on their speed test: Alaska, 20.6 megabits per second. Faster than that was Montana, 30.1 megabits per second. Maine, 30.8, slightly faster. Idaho, again, just slightly faster, 30.9. And Wyoming, 33.3 megabits per second. Some quick stats. Nationwide average internet speed was 59.5 megabits per second. So if you're at home and you can get speeds better than that, then you're on the plus side. If you're below that, well, you hope you can get better speed. Now, the state with the fastest average internet speed was Maryland at 84.1 megabits per second. And the state with the slowest average internet speed was Alaska, 20.5 megabits per second. But what if we dwell within the state? What do we get for the city? The city with the fastest average internet speed was Whitestone, New York, 138.4 megabits per second. And the city with the slowest average internet speed, Stowe, Vermont, 7.3 megabits per second. That sounds like DSL speed. Maryland ranks first for the fastest internet speed in the United States, and this was followed by Delaware and New Jersey. And these rankings hasn't changed at all in the past 2 years. If you're interested, just go to highspeedinternet.com for more information. Hackers are targeting remote desktop protocol during this COVID-19 period. Remote working is providing a huge opportunity for hackers. New research has highlighted a significant growth in the number of attacks targeting Microsoft's RDP, or Remote Desktop Protocol, and businesses have increasingly turned to Microsoft RDP as a way to help employees to work from home, with a system enabling remote workers to log onto their office computers and access business networks. In other words, what RDP does is it allows you to control your computer, mouse, and keyboard remotely, and that permits you to get into work on the business network. As a result, the number of interconnected RDP ports jumped from 3 million in January of this year to 4.5 million by the end of March, according to a report from security firm McAfee. However, this increase has also led to a spike in the number of dark web market selling. 52% of the stolen RDP credentials the company found, including more than 20,000 logins, were from networks in China, while the U.S. has roughly the same number of exposed systems. Only 4% of the stolen credentials McAfee found came from the United States. Once malicious actors compromise an RDP port, they can easily use it to send spam using a company mail server. Worse, they can use remote access to spread malware throughout the internal network. McAfee's research points out that the majority of compromised RDP ports result not from advanced malware, but simply from brute force passwords. A surprising number of internet-exposed RDP ports don't require a password at all, and many use common passwords like 123456. Securing remote desktop access is key to protecting business networks while employees continue to work from home. At a minimum, McAfee suggests restricting RDP connections over the open internet and requiring complex passwords and multi-factor authentication for login. Secure your home network. With work at home and education online, we spend more time at home now. There's never been a better time than now to secure your home network. Let's start with the most obvious, or at least it should be the most obvious thing to do. Change your default passwords to something unique and strong. There are security hacker types in the dark web that maintain massive repositories of passwords. This is the most important thing. Most home networks get broken into through either phishing or some random device they have with a bad password. It's usually a password that was never configured or never changed from the default. Use a password manager to make and store good passwords that are different for every account and device. Patch all computers, routers, and other devices on the network. The second most important thing to do is make sure you keep all your computers and devices updated with security fixes. You should enable automatic updates if available, and try to check for updates at least once a week. If you did just these two things, you'd be way ahead of the game to prevent the dark web from causing problems on your system. Enable multi-factor authentication for high-risk systems if it's available. Most people's highest-risk systems are their primary email account and their mobile phone account. These are the keys that open all doors into every other account you have because they are how you do account recovery. Next comes your social media accounts. Do you have internet-connected lights, appliances, gaming systems, media systems? Well, get their passwords changed and enable two-factor authentication. Segment your high-risk devices onto a separate network. The next strong control to consider is segmenting your network. This is where you take your higher risk systems like your entertainment systems, gaming systems, and others and place them on their own network separate from your personal computers, laptops, and phones. DNS is the domain name system, the hierarchical method by which internet addresses are constructed. DNS is a system that automatically translates internet addresses to the numeric machine addresses that computers use. Change your DNS to 1.1.1.2 or 1.1.1.3 to get privacy and malicious domain filtering. While 1.1.1.1 can safeguard user privacy and optimize efficiency, it is designed for direct fast DNS resolution, not for blocking or filtering content, The other two, which is 1.1.1.2 and 1.1.1.3, is largely used by home users who want to ensure that they have a measure of protection from security threats and can keep adult content from being accessed by their kids. So this is how you could get started right away, and remember, following these steps will massively improve your security. The Windows 10 May 2020 update will be rolling out this month. Microsoft is rolling out the Windows 10 May 2020 update, bringing new features to help with productivity, security, and speed. The update, also known as Windows 10 versions 2004, and that's kind of misleading because you think it's in the year 2004, and 20H1, and formerly referred to as April 2020 update, is expected to start rolling out to mainstream users on May the 28th. Windows 10 is now on more than 1 billion devices worldwide. Microsoft said in March that support for Windows 7 is officially over. Microsoft is encouraging users to either upgrade their PC to Windows 10 to keep it running smoothly and securely, or buy a new computer. Major refreshes to the OS comes about every 6 months, with the most recent being the November 2019 update. Early reports from ZDNet are that the latest update, which is the May 2020 update, currently available as a preview release, takes anywhere from 7 to 17 minutes to install. Not bad at all, but my caution to you is that before you do the update, make sure that backup has been properly done. What new features will be in May 2020 update? The Windows 10 May 2020 update includes a number of changes for users, according to Microsoft, such as Cortana. Microsoft says Cortana is evolving into a personal productivity assistant that can help you use Microsoft 365 apps. Cortana will be undocked from the taskbar so you can move or resize it like any other app. An improved email feature lets you use Cortana to create emails. For example, you can say, send an email to Miri, letting her know I'm running late, or show me emails from Jeff. An improved calendar lets you do the same to create and ask about meetings, and Windows lets you use the assistant to open apps and adjust settings like brightness. Search Home. Access 4 quick searches for your Search Home for easier access, like weather, top news, today in history, and new movies. Kamoji. Microsoft is adding, new symbols to its keyboards, shortcuts, along with all other emoji. Virtual desktops. Rename your virtual desktops instead of getting stuck with system issued names like desktop 1, 2, 3, 4. Automatically open apps. Opt in to settings to automatically open universal Windows platform apps after you restart your machine. Pairing Bluetooth devices with your machine will occur through notifications, so you won't need to go to the Settings app to finish the pairing. New tablet experience for 2-in-1 convertible PCs. When you detach your 2-in-1 keyboard, you'll still keep the familiar look of your desktop without interruption, while still optimizing the screen for touch. Will previous versions of Windows 10 still work? Microsoft will end support for Windows 10 1809. In other words, Windows that was released in 2018, also known as the October 2018 update. Home, Pro, Education, and Pro for Workstations editions in November of this year. And this was originally scheduled to happen in May, but again, Microsoft delayed it due to the impact of coronavirus. Enterprise and Education Editions support will last until May 2021. You can still use version 1809, but the loss of Microsoft support means you will no longer get important security patches or other updates. Do you have to update the May 2020 version? Nope. Microsoft recommends that you update, of course, but that's not mandatory unless you're about to hit an end of service date for the version you're currently running. To see which version of Windows 10 you have, go to Settings, System, About, and scroll to Windows Specifications, where you'll find the edition and version number. If you have version 1903, released in May 2019, and want to keep it, you have until December 2020 before support ends. And if you have version 1909, released in November 2019, you have until May 2021 to update. Windows 10 May 20 update may make your PC faster thanks to a clever new trick. At least that's what Microsoft claims. It looks like Windows 10 May 2020 update is coming with a clever feature to help make your PC run faster. The feature involves a tweak to the Windows search, and in the Windows 10 May 2020 update, it will no longer cause high disk usage when indexing your files. Windows Search indexes files on your hard drives in a bid to make searching for them faster. This is all well and good, but while indexing is happening, it's putting your hard drive under a lot of strain, and that can slow your whole PC down. However, the new update will allow Windows Search to identify peak usage times so it can avoid indexing when you're likely to use your PC. The improvements are more noticeable on PC using older hard drives rather than newer, faster, solid-state drives, presumably because SSDs cope with indexing a lot better, so the improvement isn't as apparent. Still, even on modern PCs, the indexing process can have an impact on SSD and CPU usage, which in turn affects the device overall performance. So if you've noticed your PC is running slowly recently, installing the Windows 10 May 2020 update could result in a boost in performance. More improvements are coming, and it is reported that Microsoft is continuing to fine-tune Windows Search, a new algorithm that will intelligently figure out when you're actively using a device and avoid running indexing procedures will be included with the Windows 10 20H2 update, which is due later this year. Why don't they just let me tell them when I can do the update? Many organizations have moved online to Zoom once the coronavirus pandemic hit. With Zoom, there is concern about security and privacy. The biggest worry is the risk of Zoom bombing, where outsiders disrupt meetings using threatening or offensive material. Zoom wasn't built for its current use. It was built for business meetings, which don't have the same level of privacy and security concerns as a massive platform for connection of all kinds. At some Zoom meetings, participants' home and cell phone numbers are displayed on the screen for everyone to see. That's a big privacy misstep. Consumer Reports vetted the advice with their own in-house security team, and this is an extract of what they published. Zoom gives the host of a meeting a lot of power over who can join and which features participants can use. If you're in charge of a Zoom meeting, the goal is to maintain a delicate balance between openness and security. The right strategy depends on, of course, the size of the meeting. There are small gatherings with a restricted guest list and large gatherings that are open to a larger group, which includes non-members. Those smaller meetings are easier to moderate because you know who's going to be attending. You need to be thoughtful about how you control access. If you're careful about who you let in the door, you can be a little more relaxed once they're in. Zoom lets participants appear in front of a virtual background that they grab from their own computers. No green screen needed, but for larger meetings that are open to outsiders, it's a good idea to consider turning off that feature because an intruder could easily post an offensive image as his or her background. Control when people can join a meeting. For large meetings, you should disable the Join Before Host feature. This feature allows participants to join before the host and hang around afterwards. However, it can also leave the meeting functionally unmoderated. You can use another setting, the Lock Meeting feature, to prevent anyone new from joining the meeting. Hosts can employ this at any time during the meeting. It can keep you safe from intruders who just stumble on the meeting partway through. disable a setting that can allow an attendee who's been removed to rejoin a meeting. Share the oversight duties by designating other co-hosts. That allows the co-host to keep an eye on the attendees, while the main host runs the event. Avoid easy-to-guess meeting names. Zoom bombers often gain access to meetings by guessing or searching the names of meetings using Zoom standard naming conventions, also known as personal meeting IDs. Generate a Zoom link automatically instead, which is harder for bad actors to guess. Perhaps most important of all, tell participants not to post links or other meeting information to their social networks. Require passwords. Well, sometimes. Some privacy experts tout the use of passwords for every Zoom meeting. Requiring password is a good policy for any meeting that is more private than public, but restricting more communal activities is a step towards less open meetings, and it should be considered very carefully. Password should be an absolute requirement for any meetings that include children or minors. Control the door for larger meetings. You can enable Zoom's waiting room function, which puts participants in a virtual vestibule outside the meeting. The host can see potential guests and then decide whether to admit them, one by one or as a group. It's a robust security practice, but it can be time and labor intensive to check everyone in a large group. If you become suspicious of just one attendee, you can place them on hold. That leaves them in the meeting, but blocks video and audio transmission between them and everyone else. Then you can decide whether they are simply someone you don't know or an intruder. Limit sharing options. For larger meetings, limiting what participants can do, you can, for example, mute all participants by default. They can then click an icon to raise their hand when they want to speak. He says it's also smart to disable screen sharing by anyone other than the host. Zoom also lets participants create a whiteboard for collaborative work with everyone adding annotations. Turn off whiteboard sharing in a large meeting. Disable or restrict chat. Disabling chat is an option for larger groups where you don't know all the participants. But even if chat is turned on, it makes sense to disable the transfer within chat or at least limit the kinds of files that can be shared. Tell participants to be cautious when clicking on links in a chat, especially if they're from someone you don't know well. Hit pause on recording. Zoom hosts have the option of recording events, but this should be used judiciously and only with permission of the attendees. Zoom hosts can allow participants to record a meeting. This feature should usually be disabled, and no one should record any Zoom meeting attended by minors unless it is done with explicit parental consent. If you get a chance, Consumers Report has a much more detailed outline on security for Zoom. I highly recommend the article. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Differences in the Work from Home Between the Business Levels.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for business. This is where I give you tidbits from my current experience, my past experience, some of the future experience of being a 30-year IT professional. What do I say future experience? Well, I can look ahead. I know some of the things that are going to be coming at us. We're going to be talking in the coming weeks, I'm sure, about the new normal and working from home, because a lot more companies are going to be sticking with what we've learned over the course of the last few weeks, months, about working from home. And there is a little bit of a difference between the businesses, how they've dealt with working from home. And this is something I know is going to be a problem as we move forward in the future. Big corporations, start off with them. The big corporations, they've had to make some adjustments. They've had to do an increase in bandwidth. They have had to change some of their policies. It used to be certain people would work from home, If you wanted to work from home, you had to have a VP approval. You know, an offices vary, and it could be a director, and it could be an SVP, and the corporate structures are named differently in different worlds. That particular one is from the finance world, yes, where there are a lot of VPs and a lot of SVPs. I've worked in the finance world many times over the course of the years. It could be a matter of your manager had to say yes or no before. Now, everybody's saying yes because we have to deal with this. But there have been minor tech issues along the way. It's a departure from the status quo, and the IT department really has the resources to handle a lot of this in the bigger corporations. Oh, we need to drop out another 1,000 laptops. Okay, well, we need to order them. They'll be here in a couple of days. Everybody who doesn't have laptops, we will get them. It's okay. You're getting paid right now. Go home and snack on some bonbons and watch soap operas. I'm sorry, that wasn't meant as a dig against anybody who would normally do that. It's as a guy, you know, we also eat bonbons. And my uncle was just fascinated by soap operas. So, yeah. Medium businesses. Is some of the above, but now let's move into that. It becomes a little bit more difficult. The medium businesses, they've had the same kind of setup, but not as many people. So there's many more hurdles, and there's a lot of training, a lot of support, and frequently a lot less laptops. You know, the smaller a business is, the more desktops they have, the less laptops they have. Changes are happening quickly. Companies are having to adapt. They're having to realize that we have a whole new set of rules here. And yes, the medium companies have had to learn more about how to manage remote workers, how to handle the technology changes, how to handle a lot of these different things. Fortunately, there have been some people who've worked in the larger corporations that know how it was done in the larger corporations, and they're bringing some of that experience at a very needed time to the medium businesses. The medium businesses, they've had to roll out more laptops. They've had to suggest things like, you're going to take your desktop home. You're going to take your computer, whatever it is that you have right now, you're going to package it up. You're going to take it home. You're going to set it up at home. Now, you need to be able to do this all on your own because we can't send out an IT person to take care of it. We can't even put somebody on the phone. You're going to come in last. And by coming in last, that means you're not going to be getting work done and your boss is going to be noticing. And that starts to get into a scary little world there, doesn't it? Let's move into the small businesses that were not prepared. Most of the small businesses were not prepared for something like this. Many small businesses are based in simple new ideas, or they're based in manufacturing, or they're based in a customer service sector like a pizza place. Sometimes these smaller companies do not have the IT work staff, so they've called in consultants. As a matter of fact, many companies under 100 people in size, they're already relying on consultants. That already starts to touch into that medium business category. And to me, it's also a matter of a mindset. You can have a company that has 5,000 people and they think like a small business. You can have a company that has 100 people and they think like a big corporation. But for the most part, small businesses, they lack the IT people. They frequently are not tech-centric at all. As a matter of fact, the few that are tech-centric enough to need people on computers is the area where I'm most concerned. They don't have the flexible budget to say, let's buy everyone a $1,000 laptop, let's upgrade our internet speed, connect up a VPN, secure everything, and have everybody work from home. I think a digital divide may occur through all of this, and I'm not sure how we're all going to fare in the end. If you run into a situation where you have spare time, I'm going to suggest there are a number of different learning places out on the internet. I'm going to name off two. LinkedIn has LinkedIn Learning, and there's something called Pluralsight, but there's many of them that will allow you to keep your tech skills up to date and honed. And at this time, I think everybody needs it. All of us need it. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. During this extended period of stay at home, many of us are passing the time by playing games while we stay at home. If you're into console gaming and nostalgia, RetroPie gives Raspberry Pi enthusiasts a set of classic games to dig through. What is RetroPie? RetroPie is a software library used to emulate retro video games on the Raspberry Pi computer. RetroPie runs Emulation Station and supports all major retro video game emulators, allowing you to play games from the NES, SNES, Genesis, Atari, and more on your Pi, thus becoming your own Raspberry Pi emulator. It's pretty easy and inexpensive to build your own Raspberry Pi retro gaming rig. For about $50, you could build your own vintage gaming rig that will hook up to any HDMI-enabled TV or monitor. For this build, you would use RetroPie, which is an awesome software package that handles all your emulation needs. There are now many versions of the Raspberry Pi, so which Raspberry Pi should you use for RetroPie? Any Raspberry Pi model can run RetroPie, but I recommend using the Raspberry Pi 4 since its more powerful GPU, CPU, and RAM capabilities will maximize the range of games you can play. I recommend a 2GB version of the Raspberry Pi 4, and RAM doesn't matter too much beyond a certain point for emulating retro games. In other words, at a certain point, the limitation is on the CPU, GPU, but not RAM. Is RetroPie legal? Yeah. RetroPie is perfectly legal. Downloading ROMs off the internet, however, is, well, technically illegal. What isn't legal is downloading or selling copyrighted ROMs, since this is similar to software piracy. I recommend that you find free legal ROMs for RetroPie rather than downloading copyrighted titles from torrent sites. RetroPie is a free software library that allows you to emulate video games on the tiny Raspberry Pi computer. It packages open source packages like Emulation Station and RetroArch into an easy-to-install gaming system. RetroPie is the most popular Raspberry Pi video game emulator. Primarily used to emulate retro video games, RetroPie allows you to emulate popular video game consoles such as the Nintendo Entertainment System, that's NES, Super Nintendo, that's SNES, Game Boy, Nintendo 64, Sega Genesis, and others. Games are loaded as individual ROM files, which can then be read by each system in RetroPie. Because the computer is called a Raspberry Pi, not Raspberry PIE, RetroPie is sometimes misspelled as RetroPie. Proper spelling is RetroPie. To build your own RetroPie system, you need a few things. Obviously, a Raspberry Pi computer and a few accessories, and the MetroPie software itself. And after assembling the hardware, simply download and install the RetroPie software. Add game ROMs and connect everything to your TV. RetroPie setup is an easy process. To install RetroPie, simply download the latest RetroPie SD card image from the RetroPie Downloads page. Then flash it onto your Raspberry Pi SD card using Etcher. It's a simple tool to use. Finally, configure RetroPie and add your game ROMs. There are numerous ways to add games to RetroPie. You can add ROMs to RetroPie using a USB drive or transfer them over your network. The USB approach is the recommended way to put ROMs on RetroPie due to the transfer speed. you also automatically have a backup of your ROMs as a result. After adding your ROMs, simply reboot the Raspberry Pi to start using them. Where do you get these ROMs for a RetroPie? It's easy to find ROMs for RetroPie. There are several different types of ROMs, including copyrighted, abandonware, public domain, and homebrew games. What games come with the RetroPie? RetroPie does not include any games by default. It's only a software library or a system for playing games. Therefore, you must find and install RetroPie ROMs on your own. No, the RetroPie software itself is completely legal. Calling it illegal is like calling a DVD player illegal because it can play illegally burned DVDs. What isn't legal is downloading or selling copyrighted ROMs, since this is similar to software piracy. I recommend finding free legal ROMs, and what you might do is do a search on free legal ROMs Raspberry Pi or for the RetroPie, rather than downloading copyrighted titles from torrent sites. What emulators are there for RetroPie? When many people ask this question, they're often asking which consoles or systems that RetroPie can emulate. This is because RetroPie provides a different emulator for each console system. Here are some of the consoles that it can emulate. The Atari 2600. Hey, I remember that. That's from a long time ago. The Atari 7800, Atari Lynx, GCE Vectrex, the NEC TurboGrafx 16, the Nintendo 64, the Nintendo Entertainment System, the Nintendo Super NES, the Nintendo Game Boy, the Nintendo Game Boy Color, the Nintendo Game Boy Advance, the Nintendo Virtual Boy, Sega 32X, Sega CD, Sega Master System, Sega Genesis, Sega Game Gear, Sega Saturn, SNK Neo Geo, SNK Neo Geo Pocket Color, Sony PlayStation, and Sony PSP. By the way, this is not a complete list. Additional supported consoles can be found on the RetroPie Wiki. You can also emulate vintage computers using RetroPie. Go have some fun, and you don't have to rely on just reading books and watching TV during this stay-at-home period. Presenting Marty Winston, All Hands on Tech, 6-month power predicament forecast.
Did you ever have a power outage that left you in the dark for more than an hour? What made that happen? How about surges on the power line? Ever have one of those fry your gear? What made that happen? Weather isn't the only reason, but it's often the primary reason for power problems. High winds and tropical systems that can blow down power lines or blow trees into pulling down power lines. Lightning storms that can take out poles, destroy transformers, and send spikes in every direction. Extreme heat that can make transformers explode or expand metal into breaking connections. Wildfires that can do even worse. Don't you wish somebody could predict that kind of consequential weather for you? Well, score a first for this show. You'll be hearing from veteran AccuWeather meteorologist Paul Pastelak with an exclusive 6-month forecast on the kinds of power problem-provoking weather conditions that various regions of the country can expect. So, Paul, what kinds of weather are we looking at?
Thunderstorms, heat waves, strong winds, tropical systems, and wildfires can lead to power surges and outages almost anywhere. Many parts of the country are more prone to these events and at different times of the year.
Okay, makes sense. Let's start with something pretty common, like, like when Thor hulks out, thunderstorms.
For the early summer of 2020, thunderstorms with strong gusty winds, isolated tornadoes can lead to more frequent power outages across the Ohio Valley, Tennessee Valley, Central Gulf Coast. Small percentage chance that outside of these thunderstorms, the lower Mississippi Valley, Central Gulf Coast, wet ground can lead to trees falling on power lines as well in these areas. A shift in the higher frequency of thunderstorms across the lower Mid-Atlantic, Carolinas, into northern and central Florida, as we get into the early part of the summer season. Lightning strikes generally high number this time of the year across Florida, and it probably will last the thunderstorm threat all the way into July.
That's a lot of potential for at least inconvenience, but I think we've all seen that it turns truly horrific when instead of just thunderstorms, the weather goes full wicked with tropical storm systems. And I don't know, does this country ever get monsoons? Wow, monsoons. Can they impact the power lines, or is it mostly the tropical systems?
The Southwest monsoon is interesting as it comes in sometime late in June or through mid-July, and that can lead to increased thunderstorms across the interior Southwest and possibility of frequent lightning strikes that can lead to surges. We're not expecting an above-normal monsoon season, but you know, you still can get some thunderstorms from, again, the middle part of July to early August that could be on the frequent side and the possibility of surges. Tropical systems can lead to widespread power outages depending on the magnitude of the storm. Now, this year, our higher confidence for an early storm is along the Gulf Coast, especially Texas or Louisiana early in the summer. Confidence looks favorable for a very active season in the Gulf of Mexico for August through early October, with potential 2 to 4 hits in this region. This can bring down power lines or create surges, and we look for some impact in June, August, and possibly 1 or 2 in September along the Gulf Coast, or even the Southeast Coast as well.
Scary. There are parts of the country that don't get that kind of storm activity, but do have to endure a lot of heat. Like Phoenix, where in the summer, hot water comes out of the cold water tap. Power lines and distribution gear can have problems, too. The cooling oil in transformers can get so hot it evaporates, leading to the transformer blowing up. In utility switchyards, where the huge amperage current is already creating heat in every connection, switchblades can soften, malform, and break connections. Is there a too darned hot factor in your forecast?
Consecutive days of high heat also can lead to spikes or surges in power, especially in the west around heavily populated areas. Now, high heat can be a higher concern in 3 to 4 areas through early fall of 2020 here. Southwest Texas in May and June, perhaps July. Northeast / Mid-Atlantic in late July and August. The third, Arizona and Southern California, May through July. And then the fourth area to watch that could come on strong is Northern California, Interior Northwest, Great Basin region, June into early August.
Okay, let's kick that up a notch. Those freaky California wildfires were all over the news last year. Are more of those likely to happen again this year?
Wildfire can be created with dry and hot conditions. Another power interruption weather maker through wildfires. Wildfires can spark naturally or by humans at any time. Now, the West more prone for widespread coverage. Last year, shutdown of the power possibly saved more than the public really knows at this point. This year, the areas that would be more prone to high power surges or outages would be Northern California, Northwest Nevada, Eastern Oregon, Washington, Western Idaho, and possibly Northern Utah. The more serious threat in this area will be late June and continue through October, peak in July and early August. Also watching northern Arizona, southern Utah, and southwest Colorado through June.
Thanks, Paul. I know you're trying to prepare us, not scare us, and I very much appreciate the work you did that went into this 6-month forecast of regional weather trends that can and do create power problems. Folks, that was veteran AccuWeather meteorologist Paul Pastelak. Hey, Paul, don't forget your umbrella. But there's another side to this, too. When it comes to power problems, you may think you're protected. Maybe you are, and maybe not. Here's a fast recap of where you may want to consider adding protection. And on places where you think you have protection, but what you have there may have already stopped being able to provide protection. We'll consider two factors, outright outages and damaging surge events. The first leaves you high and dry, and the second can make a lot of your most expensive gear fry. No lie. For outright outages, you have a few choices. One is to just focus on a few critical items, like your cable modem and Wi-Fi router, and use a UPS. That's short for uninterruptible power supply. It's a battery backup power source. Don't count on it lasting very long. There's a sort of kind of version that you may want to consider, backup batteries for specific items, like garage door openers. They don't all offer that option, but you can check. For longer-term outages, well, you may want to consider a generator. Be careful. Small generators may not produce true sine wave power and may only be good for selected pieces of equipment. And even then, those small generators may not be able to support things that, well, when they first turn on, need a lot of what's called inrush current. That's typical, for example, of things like refrigerators, air conditioners too, things with compressors, a whole house generator. And that generally means something with roughly 20 kVA, more or less 20 kilowatts of generating power. Well, that whole house generator will also need a manual or automatic transfer switch and a good deal of electrical work, probably some gas line work and maybe a concrete pad. Some of the biggest names in that category can end up costing you many times more than the generator alone by making ongoing annual fees and service calls a continuing and costly part of the package. The harder they advertise, the more likely those ongoing costs are being tacked onto the bill. Keep looking. Some brilliant alternatives, really, really good stuff. Some brilliant alternatives are much more turnkey and don't involve those extra charges. But at least now you're smart enough to ask about them, and with luck, savvy enough to notice when they try to diminish or poo-poo them. Okay, Bart, if they're so trivial, you cover them. Be aware, most power outages, well over 98% of the total count, last less than 2 seconds. The ones that extreme weather can trigger are more likely to be days to weeks long. A whole house generator is one way to deal with those. An evacuation plan is another. What's far more numerous than total outages are damaging surge events, and the word damaging is relative. A surge or a spike can come across power lines anytime there's an abrupt change in voltage or current on the line. Small surges happen all the time and only cause one interesting kind of damage that you'll hear about in a minute. Bigger surges can happen when something shorts out a power line, or when a downstream line breaks, or when a huge manufacturing plant turns on its equipment, or when a transformer blows up, or when lightning hits a power line or close to it. You may think you're protected if you have a power strip with surge protection, or an outlet adapter with surge protection, or a UPS with surge protection. Now, if any of those are more than 2 years old, well, just because they came with surge protection doesn't mean they still offer any. There's an electronic component called an MOV. An MOV converts surges into heat in a metallic chemical reaction. And every time there's a surge, a little more of the MOV is gone forever. The term damaging is relative, remember? And small surges happen all the time. So normal electrical junk on the power lines is like a constant emery board to an MOV. And just being plugged in means that over time, those MOVs lose their ability to stop surges. You might guess that if small, always there surges can make an MOV fail in 2 years, give or take, bigger surges can wipe it out faster, and a really big surge can destroy it in milliseconds. Maybe you knew that, maybe not, but here's something that only a very few people know. Those little surge strip LEDs that you're supposed to believe are telling you that you're still protected have absolutely no way of knowing that. Those lights are meaningless. In fact, the only way to tell if an MOV is still good is to cut it open and examine it with a microscope, at which point, of course, it's absolutely not good anymore. There is a new alternative to the MOV called the GMOV. It piggybacks an MOV with a gas discharge tube, and the combination is effective for a decade or longer. But so far, nobody making surge strips seems to be using GMOVs. A more industrial-strength MOV, in fact, clusters of many, may be among the countermeasures used in building a whole-house surge protector. These also use other time-proven technologies to tame surges and spikes, and they can last for decades. Talk to your electrician about these. They install at the breaker box and cost only a few $100s, plus whatever you pay the electrician. The odds are that once you install one, you won't need to replace it for as long as you own your house. And it's still working lights really do relate to whether or not it's still protecting you. That's whole house surge protectors. But that's just the power line. Several years ago, lightning hit a backyard tree 2 houses over. That huge power pulse made its way back into the house over the phone, cable TV, and internet connections and fried 19 pieces of electronic equipment. The pulse crossed from the cable and internet and phone lines through the gear they connected to and into the house's power lines, and things plugged into surge protectors weren't immune. Those surge protectors were toast before the surge was halfway over. Hit the surge engines, and you can find surge protectors for coax TV cables, for RJ45 Ethernet lines, and more. Speaking of Ethernet, if you have a PoE, that's power over Ethernet, a PoE surveillance camera outdoors, put an Ethernet surge protector as close to the camera as you can get. Our rack has two banks of Ethernet surge protectors between the Ethernet switch and the cabling runs, but there's also a second surge protector at any outside gear. So, now you have a fresh helping of advice on how to deal with two classes of power problems, plus, thanks to veteran AccuWeather meteorologist Paul Pastelak, a six-month forecast for what kinds of extreme weather are likely to hit which regions of the USA and trigger those power predicaments. Next time, in hopes that our ASUS support issues don't extend into a sixth week, our Igor the Switch segment should resolve the cliffhanger of our earlier retrofitting Frankenstein segment, which you can still hear at PCRadioshow.org. If that gets bumped again, you may hear our explanation of why CES should skip its January 2021 show and what alternatives are out there for holding trade shows at all. And if you're not here next week, you'll never know which one you missed.
Thank you, Marty. This past week on May 8th was VE Day, the end of World War II in Europe. Even though 16 million Americans fought in the Second World War, the number of veterans from the conflict still alive today are failing quickly. According to the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, just 389,000 are still alive today. We salute them for their services. At this point in the program, we generally make public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical assistance, the club members are more than happy to assist. All these club meetings are open, free to the public. However, at this time, because of the coronavirus stay-at-home order, all the computer clubs have canceled their meetings. You can go to our website, PCRadioshow.org. We have the computer clubs listed, and if you go to the website, you can check when they do schedule a meeting, and some of them are holding remote virtual meetings, so you may be interested in following up on them. Our website is PCRadioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet and PCRadioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank@PCRadioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups and heed the guidance of staying at home. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and remember, keep 6 feet apart. And if it's less than 6 feet, just back up, back up, back up. And until we meet again, same time, same station next week. In a few minutes at 7 p.m., join your neighbors and shout out into the streets your thanks and support for all the first responders, the nurses, the doctors, the EMT workers, the firemen, the policemen, the workers who maintain the supply of food, and all those who have to remain on the job to maintain essential services.